Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us today on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Victoria Gaither. And if you want to learn more about me and our guest today, Dr. Julius Bailey, then check out the chat room. There are some links about both of us inside the chat room. And we're just happy that you took some time out of your afternoon to join us for what Dr. Bailey and I consider to be a very important discussion and also a discussion that people are literally having around the world. And Dr. Bailey, that was basically the hug that was seen around the world, and that was the hug that was done by Brant Jean. He is the brother of Botham Jean, who was shot and killed by Amber Geiger. Amber was found guilty of murdering Botham, and she received 10 years in prison as a result of that. Dr. Bailey, are you on the line? And thank you for joining us.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Victoria. It is a great opportunity to join you again. Brings back a lot of memories in history of us having conversations on critical issues that affect the nation.
It does, and I think one of the last conversations that we would have had when both of us were very young in our career back in Decatur, Illinois, and those were some wonderful times, and also a lot of community work you and I did back then, didn't we?
No question.
And, of course, your work as a professor continues. Dr. Bailey is a professor of philosophy at Wittenberg University, which is located in Ohio. Dr. Bailey, I wish that we were joining together under better circumstances in terms of things to discuss. But, of course, we are discussing the Amber Geiger trial that took place. And I'm hoping that you, as a man of religion, you as a professor of philosophy, will be able to help all of us sort of bring into context what has happened and sort of where we're going to go on from the future. But what I would like to do before we start the conversation, I'm going to play a clip from CNN, and this is a clip of Brant Jean that day inside the courtroom. So here we go.
Okay.
I'm not going to say I hope you rot and die just like my brother did, but I personally want the best for you. And I wasn't going to ever say this in front of my family or anyone, but I don't even want you to go to jail. I want the best for you. Because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please? Please?
Yes.
And that was the clip, again, that was the hug, literally, that was seen and sort of heard around the world. How do we begin to actually unpack that? First of all, when you saw that, Dr. Bailey, how did it make you feel?
Wow. Yeah. No. I mean, just hearing it again, it's riveting. It really is, because I believe, you know, with my heart that what we witnessed on that day and what we just heard again for those on the radio, I think it stands, quite frankly, I think it stands alongside what Mamie Till did and her display of her son Emmett Till's corpse in the casket after being brutally killed for allegedly whistling at a white woman in Mississippi. I think what she said, that she had no time to hate, that I think that language that she gave in 1956, I believe, it's the same language that Brant Jean, John is saying, that for him, I can only imagine this public display of forgiveness was what was needed for him, right, and for his psyche and for his heart. And I think his mother, Allison, right, you know, even says, like, this is the first time that he's ever spoke about this thing in public. And so I think what a powerful sort of reveal, if you will, of this young man and his sense of compassion and tenderness and humility. But the problem is, though, that he, so I think it's clear that he couched this response in an homage to his brother, and his brother, who we know was a choir leader and a devout Christian, and so he represented a sort of a Christian performance, right, of love, and I get that, and so did Mamie Till in 56, but when Mamie Till opened that casket and showed America the disfigured body of her son by white hatred, when Brandt spoke from that stand, it became a public moment, though, Victoria, right? So that private move of sort of emotion and forgiveness really became a public moment. And so Mamie's, if we remember, Mamie Till's next line was, not only can I not hate, but I must spend the rest of my life fighting for justice, right? Mm-hmm. So when Mamie Till died in 2003, I'm sorry, I forgot that. But when she died, I believe that she never sought justice for her son, that no one was ever convicted. Actually, the guys went to trial and by all-white jury, and they were acquitted. And so she died never seeing justice for her son. So by extension, what we're witnessing is a criminal justice system that still acquits primarily white folk for the murder and sort of traumatizing acts against black people. And so Brandt, in this case, he asked for a hug, right? He didn't ask for justice. He asked for a hug. And then he relegated justice, I think. He said, this is what I need, a hug. I need friendship, I think he even said in the line that we didn't hear. I need friendship. I don't even want jail time, right? And then he said, can I just have an embrace? And so, you know, call me crazy, call me traumatized, call me whatever you want to. But in that space, in that public space, in that moment in that courtroom, to watch a hug, or actually what we watch is about three or four hugs that Amber didn't want to let him go. It's a whole different question. but when you watch that hug and then a 10-year sentence by a jury who also said they cried, and a judge who cried, and a victim's family, and even a bailiff who cried, Victoria, I just think this just slaps history right in the face. Where is the tears for black folk? Where is the forgiveness and the restitution and the restoration for us? That's what I want to know.
Now, in saying what you just commented on, I guess our listeners should know that Dr. Bailey is a professor of race relations. I mean, this is what you do. You've written books about it. You study this. You've written many papers about it. So obviously from the prism of how you see things, and we talked about this a couple of days ago, because I said to you, I said, are we able to separate race from this situation, and are we able to call it this sort of Christian act of forgiveness? And your answer to me, Dr. Bailey, was what?
Well, I think it's difficult, especially for black people in America, it's difficult, if not impossible, to separate race from our understanding of Christianity, right? I mean, we just can't, right? And so I think that what we have to understand is that although this becomes a very important moment for, you know, a lot of folk, black and white alike, right? But, you know, the white evangelicals all over the nation, oh, this is a great day for race relations, right, and all this kind of stuff. And then even, you know, various, you know, class levels of black folk, are kind of calling this an example of Christian love. And the only question I would say, though, with that is not that it's not, you know, an example of love. I just think that, you know, to understand Christ biblically is to realize that Christ certainly, you know, told people, hey, you forgive 70 times 7. There is no just one time to forgive. But Christ forgave after someone was contrite. Christ forgave after someone came to him. We know countless examples of Christ's condemnation. He condemned the Pharisees. He condemned the Sadducees. He certainly measured that people who are operating under the aegis of evil need to be held accountable. That's also Christ. And so that's why I get confused in this moment, that especially with, you know, for us who black folk who are trying to fight for justice, we can't separate love from justice. We can't separate love and it says that I need to love, I need to love. Yeah, you need to love, but love is also an expression, an aspect of justice. And so for many of us who see our sons and our grandsons and ourselves in these courtrooms, we didn't get no love. We haven't gotten no justice. We haven't received these things. And so for me, it's one of the examples of a level of hypocrisy that it is expected for black folk to all, and it's not just us, right? If you look at this from a class perspective, that it's always poor folk that can't, you know, you need to just shut up and accept what we give you. Right? When they told LeBron James and the basketball players, y'all can't be protesting, just shut up and dribble. When you're having these conversations, say, wait a minute, don't I? And that's the same question that Sojourner Truth asked to all the white men and even black men in the 19th century. Look, ain't I a woman? Right? Don't I have something to say? Right? And that is to say that in these circumstances, although we can separate Brother Brandt's personal moment, his mama's personal moment, the family's personal moment, that was for them. They needed that. But this was in public space in a courtroom that historically has traumatized and hated black folk. And when we see this black man hugging this white woman and these black women stroking the hair of this white woman and this black judge coming down and hugging this black woman, you cannot help but think of histories of black folk who have been on the underside of that system and not receiving the same type of sympathy.
And it's interesting that you would say that, because I've been, of course, reading different point of views and articles about this, and something that really struck me was an article that was written in the Washington Post, and this writer went on to say that if white people expect all black people to extend forgiveness as quickly as Brandt Jean did, then they understand neither black people nor black pain. And that sentence, I think, sort of really got me to thinking, because I thought, yeah, you know, it really is, it really does boil down to that, and this sort of you know, understanding of black pain in general. And I think, you know, in cases like this, especially cases that make national headlines, you know, we as a group of people, although I did not know Botham Jean, you know, he very well could have been somebody that I see every single Sunday in church. So, you know, but Botham Jean,
right.
I didn't know him, but I kind of do know him, you know. So because I kind of do know him, I too am deeply affected by what happened to him, deeply affected, you know, with his family, his entire community. So I think that was one aspect. I think that perhaps could be a learning lesson for other people, is that, you know, sort of black people collectively as a group, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm in Washington, D.C., you're in Ohio, or you're somewhere overseas, when something like that happens, it literally collectively in our body, in our soul, who we are, it affects all of us to our core.
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, because you cannot, and I think that was the basis of your question. I think you can individually have responses, but you cannot, especially in these public spaces like courtrooms, especially in these public spaces like television and media, that we all see ourselves through the prism of the other, right? I mean, that's philosophical.
Yeah.
It's, you know, but it's real. But you know, we see ourselves through that prism. And so for me, it's just curious. And I work at an institution. I work at a predominantly white institution. I pretty much have always worked at predominantly white institutions, and I have colleagues who, you know, who sort of exercise this sort of Christian temperance and this idea of love, while at the same time being very silent to injustice, right? So I'm looking at them kind of halfway, like, well, like how can you say you love Christ, but then at the same time, are you sort of hating on problems that this world has, right? And so that's why, you know, I think it's sort of I wouldn't even say unfair at this point, because fairness is out the window. I mean, we've realized that, you know, race and fairness is not two words that is going to come together in this country no time soon. I think now we got to ask a question about equity. I think there is a sense of equity, not only in an economic sense, but I think equity in a spiritual sense. There is a sense to which we have to be able to grieve in the way we want to grieve. We have to be able to be told that your rage is okay, you know what I'm saying, and realizing that it's okay to be mad, and maybe even in the spirit of Christ, I can turn over some tables, right? You need to allow me to turn some tables over and allow this to come through, because we know, for instance, when Leslie McSpadden said, you know, the mother of Michael Brown said, I can't forgive that brother. I can't forgive that cop. When Eric Garner's mama said, no, I'm not going to forgive him. No. When Tamir Rice's mama said, wait a minute. I know I have to forgive. I think the same thing that Sabrina Fulton said. I know I have to forgive. That's for me. But I'm not going to forgive until there's restitution. I'm not going to forgive until there's contriteness, not only in the spirit of the officer, but also in the spirit of this nation. I'm not going to forgive you as an institution of criminal justice when you constantly bombard black folk and you don't find justice for my son. But on the flip side, right, we immediately, you know, lauded Sam Dubow's mama when she said of that cop Ray Tensing, yeah, I must forgive him. Or, you know, when we were asked, you know, the folk at the Greater Emmanuel Church in South Carolina, right, you know, what do you have to say today? I'm like, well, can we grieve first? Well, no, you're a church. What do you have to say? Okay, well, yeah, we have to forgive, okay? We have to forgive. That's what you want. Why? Because just as Paul Laurence Dunbar said over 100 or some years ago, we wear the mask, right? Black folk are always being asked to wear the mask, right, to sort of stave off malaise, stave off hurt, stave off pain, and just smile, right? That sort of Louis Armstrong reality, even in the face of pain,
right.
Just smile. And so that we have to always wear this public mask of black sort of being passive. We have to wear the public mask of just acceptance and tolerance. We have to wear the public mask of forgiveness. We have to even wear the public mask. You know, I'm thinking of W.E.B. Du Bois, who had to wear the public mask of ignorance, even though he might have been the smartest man in America. You know what I'm saying? We always have to denounce ourselves in order for, quite frankly, white supremacy to live. And I'm convinced that if you truly love humanity, if you truly love yourself, and if you truly love all those who come in between the two, that love necessitates a bit of agitation. And you cannot just blindly accept without pushing and pushing and pushing. So we can thank Brother Brandt for what he did and realize that was important for him, but also put this context that was on national TV and realize that for the next 20 years, we'll probably be watching that scene, and we're going to have to deal with that as a people. We're going to do that as a nation, because if you truly want to deal about forgiveness, you really want to deal about you know, issues of racial reconciliation, you have to come to grips with truth. And truth is, at a certain level, we have found ourselves to put black people, poor people, gay, lesbian, transgendered people on the backside of history. And at the same time, we find ourselves saying we need to forgive, but yet we constantly put pressure on those who are the oppressed. And I'm just confused about how this hypocrisy just seems to just flow easily out of the mouths, especially of the political right, but even in the mouths of the black bourgeoisie. It shocks me.
Well, it's interesting that you would say that, because one of the reasons why this conversation came about today was because I was just having so many feelings, and I didn't know quite what to do and what to think, because after the hug had happened, you know, you go on social media and there are memes and there are all of these different comments and things going on, and, you know, people really ripped Brandt apart over that, and just sort of the dialogue that was actually taking place between between blacks within the black community to hug or not to hug, so to speak. And, you know, it was also interesting that, you know, this not only made news in America. I was talking to my counterpart from New Zealand broadcaster Street Brick mm-hmm. yesterday, and he said to me, he says, everybody in New Zealand is watching this on television. He says, this is dominating discussion here in New Zealand. And if you don't follow me, I am a New Zealand resident. I lived in New Zealand for over 5 years, so I'm very close to the country, and I've done a lot of speaking and media there in New Zealand. But it was very interesting from a point of view of Stu from another country who's a white New Zealander. And he said to me, he says, you know, just that mere image of them hugging in the courtroom, he said, it made me feel uncomfortable. He said it freaked me out. It was creepy to me. I didn't know what to make of it. And he, you know, sort of talked about how the hug was for a very long time. It wasn't a sort of hug and release, you know, when you go hug somebody and you give them a big hug and then you're done. But you know, he sort of talked about how this hug lasted, you know, and it lasted for a while, and it was something about that just made him feel very, very uncomfortable. So, Dr. Bailey, I just sort of throw that out there to you just to talk about it from an international standpoint to get back to what you just said about how, you know, we're going to be reliving this and seeing these images for here and now then to come. You know, we're going to be talking about what happened, what transpired in that courtroom, not only here in America, but also overseas as well. I do want to play another clip because you've been talking a lot, and I want to give you a bit of a break. So this is Brent. This is what he had to say the next day following the hug. And this clip, guys, is only about a minute and 19 seconds. So here we go.
Well, at the time, I didn't know the cameras were on. After the sentencing, I saw Amber's family leave the room, and along with Amber, and we left and came back. Upon coming back, I didn't think any cameras would be on. I thought it was over because we have the conviction, we have the sentencing, and I was asked to. They asked all of us, any of us who wanted to do the
victim
impact statement, and that's when I came up and I said, I'll do it. And then I was called, and not knowing the attention it would get, but I did it. I said what I had to say. I meant what I said. And I thank God that I got the courage to say it.
It's important to note that, and Brandis told me before, that 2 minutes before he gave the impact statement, he wasn't giving any statement. And then 2 minutes later, he was in the witness box, speaking his heart to the person who murdered his brother. It showed incredible bravery, but it wasn't something done for show. And I think that's the reason it's connected so well all over the country.
So there you have it. That was a clip that was from CNN from Brandt, who talked about why what transpired and how it is that actually happened. And just to sort of throw in there, the family, the Jean family, they are originally from St. Lucia. So there's been sort of people I saw on social media asking about, you know, the accent. So, you know, I just wanted to throw that out there, Dr. Bailey. You know, he says, obviously, you heard him, that, you know, he spoke from his heart. Victim impact.
Right.
He didn't know that the cameras were still on. I saw an interview on CNN from his mother, Allison, who spoke, and she said, you know, listen, this, what you saw there on display is an example of my son who has been raised as a Christian since he was knee high. He's always been, you know, taught the principles of the Bible, forgive and treat one as you do to others. And that is what you saw there on display. And she goes on to say that she was very proud of him. And also that for a moment of him speaking in the courtroom that day, that she felt her son, Botham, who was sort of channeling through him, because that would be something that he would say. So with that, Dr. Bailey, yeah, he obviously stands 100% behind what he had to say, which again goes to my earlier point, was that he obviously needed to do that so that he could move forward within his own life, and I think no one can hold him, hold anything against him for that.
No, I agree. I mean, that's why, again, I prefaced my comments saying that we have to give him the space to, act and operate how he wants to operate. But what I did find interesting, though, and I hadn't heard that clip. What I do find interesting is that, the philosopher in me just really wants to know, like, what would have happened if he knew the cameras were on, right? Is there sort of an internal silencing or sort of a pressure by a community or realizing, the impact that this might take around the world? Would he have remained silent the way he said he was going to leading up, to a minute or two before the event, right? That's what came to my mind, like, wow, like if he had knew the cameras were on, would he have made the statement, even though you believed it, right? Because, again, there's nothing biblically that says I need to forgive you publicly, right? So, I mean, that has nothing to do with Christ, right? So, I mean, he made a, so he could have forgave, it had been well in his soul and been done with it. Right. And I think that's what he was doing, not knowing that international eyes would be on him. And I think that is the interesting part, which then that's why I said absolves him from this conversation for me, because an individual act doesn't necessarily move to the universal in the way that we cultural critics have to move it that way. Right. We have to somehow see this as a continuum, not just as an isolated case. Right. We have to see it as a continuum because this is a public, that court is a public court. That judge, it represents a polity, right? These were public acts, right? That jury is an example of a democratic and a sort of experiment called the criminal justice system. So all this is public, even though his heartfelt thoughts, it might have been private.
And I do want to mention we've got somebody that has joined us inside the chat room, so thank you so much. And anyone can join the chat room. It's just a matter of clicking on the link, and you'll see chat, and feel free to tell us your comments. And this is a comment from a gentleman. He says, cops must be held to a higher standard. Involuntary manslaughter is a violation of the public trust and cannot be tolerated for a police officer. Goes on to say the 10-year sentence is a miscarriage of justice. And that was perfect, Dr. Bailey, because I wanted to segue into Judge Tammy Kemp and also to talk about the sentence. I did a little bit of research. I won't go into a lot of detail, but just to give you some facts about Judge Tammy Kemp, she used to be a Dallas County prosecutor before she was a actual judge. Now, she also, apparently, if you watch the trial, you notice that she writes a lot. She writes longhand notes on the bench as a way that she says to focus. That's a tactic that she uses. She attended the University of Oklahoma Law School and graduated in 1988. And I think probably one of the most controversial parts about her is that she ruled that the jury could consider the state's Castle Doctrine in the trial. Listen, I'm no scholar, but I do think that the Castle Doctrine says that your home is your castle and you have a right to defend it. And, of course, the first thing that came to my mind was, but she wasn't in her own home. So how does that, sort of, right? And, again, I know nothing about law. I'm no scholar, but that was the sort of first thing that popped into my mind, that she wasn't in her own home when she shot him. She was inside Botham's apartment. So I didn't quite understand that. I'm sure scholars like you will continue to debate that. But the last big thing, the video that was seen around the world, was Judge Kemp hugging Geiger. That went viral. And also that she personally gave her Bible. That is a lot, Dr. Bailey, to actually unpack. Like, where do you start from that?
Yeah, I mean, so my disgust, if you will, came in the composite. It didn't come with the brother Brandt, in isolation. It came as a composite with that extended hug that Amber Dessine wouldn't let go. And as I said, every time I see that, I think of, she reached back three times, and I'm thinking, how many folk in history have been killed for touching a white woman like this, right? And I'm just, that's what I kept thinking in my mind, like, this is crazy. And maybe it's a progression of America? I don't know. But I looked at that, and then I also looked at the sister bailiff who's brushing the hair, and I looked at the judge, and all I can think about is what it is, and this is sensitive to me because I work at a predominantly white university, and I'm doing it, but it's sensitive to me in this sense because we tend to give a lot of credence to the tears of white women, and not to say they aren't real. I'm not here to judge, you know, its realness or the veracity, but there's something about the psyche of white supremacy that then sort of forces all those under the aegis of it to give a little bit of sympathy to white women, even when white men don't. And that's the crazy thing. Even when white men abuse and white men don't, you know, allow their women to vote, you know, when they don't allow their women to work, when they don't allow their women to sort of use their body the way they want to use their bodies. Even though they have experience this history hypocritically, we still want to give credence to that. And so when I seen that judge, again, call me whatever you want to call me, but I immediately just felt that here again, a black woman is asked to mother a white girl. And this history of black women being forced to be surrogate mothers to these white girls, and the stroking of the hair reminded me of Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye, right? And this idea of how do we understand beauty, and how do we understand, you know? And so I'm just like, this is crazy for me. But I'm like, what is going on here? Like, when does this ever happen to a black defendant? When does it happen to a brown defendant? When does it happen to a gay defendant? When does it happen to a, you know, so but there's something about the combination. I ended here. There's something about the combination of white women's tears and the combination of, I think, the police that sort of renders these type of situations with a little bit more love than it would be anywhere else.
Yeah, quite interesting. And there have been several groups that have actually filed complaints. I did find one. This is a Wisconsin group that's filed a complaint against Judge Kemp. And they basically go on to, of course, talk about separation of church and state. But they also go on to say that act of compassion undermines her credibility as an impartial judge. So I think, you know, that was sort of one of the first things that kind of popped into my mind was that, you know, you're supposed to be fair and you're supposed to be partial. So how can I believe you as a judge who sat through this entire trial having to make decisions, having to listen to the evidence, having to do all of these things of what you do as a judge? And then at the end, you know, not only are you going to give a hug, but you're going to take your own personal Bible present it sort of, you know, to her. So so it is going to be interesting to see what actually comes of that, Dr. Bailey, if anything is going to come of that.
Right. And if you don't mind, I mean, just quickly, I mean, you know, I watched the trial Tuesday and Wednesday, and one of the first things that shocked me was when the prosecutor was asking Amber to, you know, put on the equipment that she had on the night of the shooting, and she acted like she couldn't do it, like she was paralyzed in emotion, and then the camera showed the judge. In that moment, the judge was crying. And I'm looking, this is Tuesday or Wednesday.
Yes.
I'm like, what the hell is this? Excuse me, what is the judge
You're
crying
no, that's
about?
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Like,
no,
what
I
is she crying
that.
About?
I,
like, you know?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I,
so
I
that,
saw that
so,
too.
So if there's impartiality.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I'm saying if there is partiality, I think that examples like that over the course of the trial where she cried along with the defendant, I think that is a something to be looked at. The Bible at the end, I mean, I'm not as tripped out about that for two reasons. One, she didn't give the sentence. And two, but the sentence was already given and it was over. So her job was over, right? So there's a sense to which, yes, there may be some impartiality. Yes, separation of church and state, whatever. But and yes, that courtroom is always hers, right, as a representation of the state, right? It's always hers. So I get that argument. But I don't think that in that display affected the 10 years, that display affected the sentence at all. I mean, matter of fact, if we understand the jury said very specifically what impacted their 10 years was the brother, right? Because said the brother convinced them that both of them wouldn't have wanted that. So, which again makes us think back to Brant's thing. If in fact Brant wouldn't have got on that stage, would the jury have given her 20 years or 30 years? Because again, said that she, right, because the jury said, listen, we were all unanimous at the point in which she said, I intended to kill him. That was the letter of the law. So she admitted to the letter of the law, and I gave, but because the brother stood up there and said that, and he said, and we all cried in the jury. I'm like, how many tears are out of here, right?
Everybody's crying. It's a big cry fest. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I've got to move this along just a little bit because we only have 9 minutes, but I want to get in any thoughts, the last thought about the Dallas Police Department, because we saw yet again on display how corrupt police departments are in America, and it's going to be interesting to see if the Dallas Police Commissioner, and she said that she would, but of course we'll see, if anything is going to come of this. What do you think? Yes or no? What do you think?
This meaning what? The 10 years?
Meaning that they're going to reevaluate the Dallas Police Department, reevaluate, you know, sort of from start to finish, because, you know, it took a while before they even arrested Amber, you know, this sort of special treatment that she got and that she really was in the beginning. The book was going to be closed, and Amber thought she was going home, you know, until there was a bit of stink that, you know. So do you think that there's going to be any internal reviews there at the Dallas Police Department?
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably will. I think, you know, we know that, for instance, that that police commissioner who also is a sister, right, Renee Hill, I think her name is. I think she's a black woman, right? And so, you know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, how she plays this out and the pressure that the, you know, fraternal order police puts upon them to actually restore Amber's type of credibility and that kind of thing. I don't think that there is a question here of I don't think that the police will question whether or not this was some issue related to training. I think that they all have fundamentally said. You remember the Texas Rangers said, "Hey, they don't see a crime here." Right. And so they specifically said that. So I don't think there's going to be investigation on the policies of the department. But what might be interesting, and I don't know if you or your listeners have heard this, but just yesterday, the key witness of the trial was shot and killed in the mouth and the chest. So there was a young black boy who lived across from Bolton and John, who was scared to testify in the first place, but testified that he heard the conversations and testified against what Amber said the conversation was leading up to the shooting. He said he heard it all, and he was a key witness. Yesterday, they found him dead in Dallas with a shot with a bullet in the mouth and a bullet in the heart. So what I'm interested about, I'm not here. I don't know nothing, right? I'm just saying we saw this in St. Louis. Right, we saw this in St. Louis after the Ferguson trial. We saw three young black men who were involved in the protest in Ferguson. In, you know, within a period of 4 years, all were killed in mysterious type of ways. So I don't know. Could this be a part of police? I'm not here to say that. I'm just saying what would be interesting to find out is to what extent that the police is going to rally around this issue.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and I don't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to get in mention it here in the chat room where the gentleman says the police union will force Dallas Police Department to protect that officer, because basically they're only going to protect their own. So I think this person that's here with us is actually agreeing, Dr. Bailey, with most of what you're saying. If you are just joining us, I did a terrible job because we were just so into the conversation. I'm your host, Victoria Gaither, and joining us is Dr. Julius Bailey. He's a professor of philosophy at Wittenberg University in Ohio. If you want to learn more about Dr. Bailey, go to his website, juliusbailey.com. I tried to post that in the chat room, but it wouldn't work, so I'll make sure that I put that in the show information, because Dr. Bailey is always, different places speaking, and, we're always excited about what you have to say. I wish we had more time. We've got 5 minutes left, but I didn't want to leave our show, Dr. Bailey, without us mentioning something about Diane Carroll. Of course, we lost her. She's an American actress, a singer, a model. She rose to prominence in some of the earliest major studio films that feature black cast, Carmen Jones, Porgy and Bess. She leaves behind one child, Suzanne Kay, who I believe is a film director and very much into the film industry herself. But such a loss. Anything that you want to say about her? Because we're going to end with a clip, and this clip will be Diane Carroll when she accepted the Tony, and that was one of the first time that, you know, you had people of color that would ever win a Tony Award for her work.
Yes. We appreciate her life. We appreciate her travail and the kind of challenges that she had as a black actress in the early 20th century to sort of engage race and art at the same time. And so she's in that trajectory. And so she's a phenomenal woman, an outstanding diva who blazed the trail for a lot of the actresses that we see now who took the lumps and the hits and the lashes of racist America, and she lived through it. And I thank God for her life and for her her story.
Well, Dr. Bailey, that is well said, and I have nothing to say after that because you summed it up. So I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I didn't get a chance to get to all of the emails. I don't have a producer, so it's been me that's been sort of handling the show by myself.
Okay.
But I will say we did have one young man that came in. His name is Ralph, and he says he knows Dr. Bailey, that he follows you, and he also said that you need more airtime, and when are you going to come back to do another show? So, listen, Dr. Bailey, you're invited back anytime. You can come back anytime. We've got anything that we want to discuss, and I would love having you back whenever you want to come, okay?
Thank you very much, Victoria.
Thank you. And here's the clip that we're going to end Diane Carroll.
I wanted this. I'm like Abe Burrows. I really wanted this. If you think I'm not going to talk about Richard Rodgers, you're crazy. I've wanted to be on Broadway for 7.5 years. And he put me there. I would like to go on and do other things, but I will never forget, because this man knocked on my door. He called me, and I love him, and thank you very much.